You're listening to the Law of Attraction Radio Network.
Welcome to Quantum Leap Book Club. During the next hour, beloved mind scientist Parisha and her guests from around the world will read and discuss various best-selling books with well-known authors. Every show will apply retention techniques designed to help you to absorb powerful knowledge to effectively change your life. Join us every week for a thought-provoking hour and re-listen as often as you can. You will be delighted by what you learn, and you will be excited by the results. Are you ready to take the quantum leap?
This is Quantum Leap Book Club, and our regular host, Parisha, will not be joining us tonight as she's traveling and teaching, so her co-host will cover tonight's material. We have as our co-host, Geraldine Delby Ball, environmental biologist from Sydney, Australia, Trina Cooper, lifelong entrepreneur from Denver, Colorado, Rosemary Heyer, English teacher working with children in Frankfurt, Germany, Dr. Joyce Mullenhauer, Doctor of Naturopathy in Kingman, Arizona, and Marianne Love, myself. I'm a psychologist from Melbourne, Australia. And our book this evening is I Could Do Anything If I Only Knew What It Was by Barbara Sher. And we're covering chapters 6 to 10 this evening, and we're broadcasting through Law of Attraction Network Radio. So let's begin. Like, this is a fantastic book and really interesting to go through and do all the exercises in it. So I really hope everybody out there has a copy of the book, because it's through the application that you'll discover parts of yourself. Even if you think you're going quite well in your career or in your life choices, I think this book is still really relevant to keeping on fine-tuning those extra areas where you get closer to living a passionate life and living a really fulfilled life. So I can see myself using this book to continue to tweak areas of my life. Even though I'm quite happy in my career, I can still feel that the development will be really useful for me and my growth and getting closer to who I want to live and be as. So I'm really looking forward to hearing now from Rosemary, who's going to cover the first chapter that we're discussing in this book this evening.
Yes, hello. Thank you, Marianne. Yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of fun to do the exercises and look at some of the things and see where you can actually, work on really having a life fulfilling. In chapter 6, she's addressing one of the resistances we have, or one of the experiences we have when we look at what is it we want to do. And the title of this chapter is, I Want Too Many Things, I'm All Over the Map. And what she actually created in her work, and she's introducing that in this chapter, is the scanner. And it is really widely used in her coaching, and many, many participants have been using that, because I remember years ago I heard that the first time, and it was really true revelation for me, and it freed up so much energy for me. So I think that I'm a scanner. What is a scanner? A scanner is someone who has a lot of interests, but never really becomes an expert in one of the areas. Usually it can be a poet or a naturally gifted teacher or a brilliant salesperson, someone who is kind of like a Renaissance person, like she's saying in the book, like Leonardo da Vinci or Ben Franklin or Thomas Jefferson were scanners. And it's not a person who's really having a failure or anything like that, but someone who's having many, many projects and many, many ideas. And one of the things is for me is like making to-do lists, and she's sharing that in the chapter two, is making to-do lists or writing projects in my calendar is a really challenge, because it's endless and I do a lot of ideas and I have a lot of things I'm writing down. So basically the challenge of a scanner for me also is to work with time management, because Barbara Sher, of course, is saying you can do everything. You can do all the projects and you can do all the ideas. It's just a matter of how you schedule your time. And she has a very nice exercise in the book where you actually write 10 projects or 10 areas. She calls it actually 10 lives in your list. And then you just start scheduling it right now. And you have various ideas. She has, like, you can combine two of the projects. Maybe you want to be a world traveler and a poet, so you can write while you're traveling or something like that. Or you can do one project daily, like at a minimum of 3 minutes, or maybe 20 minutes each day. And another project or another life, you can live on the weekend only. and another life maybe only occasionally. She says you can fit all of that into your life. You simply have to design your life to make it work. So she says, don't fit your ideas into your present circumstances, but create your circumstances. And another one she's introducing is actually a diver. And this diver is someone, not like a scanner. A diver is actually someone who specializes and who likes to go into depths of topics. And she talks about the unhappy, frustrated diver. And I think that was really something interesting for me, because there's a lot of people, especially younger people nowadays, who have a really hard time to commit to something. And she's talking about the fear of commitment is coming from because they think that it is a trap, that they are trapped in it forever. So they, to avoid that, they move into new projects constantly. Actually, she says it's an emotional addiction, a chemistry in your body that you just right away start something new. You don't want to stay with a project because you feel trapped. And her remedy, and she's always very practical in that, is that you try for 30 days a very small commitment. I really like that, and I think I'm going to do that to experience it again. A small commitment, like maybe making an omelet or learning how to jiggle a ball or doing an exercise, and you do it every day for 30 minutes until you have mastered it in 1 month. And the idea is that you are experiencing what it means to master something, what it means to have a commitment. And I really like that idea because it helps a lot of people who are afraid of commitment to see that when you stick to something and when you master something, there's a whole new possibilities coming up. So this chapter was really good for me, a wonderful reminder, because to be a scanner is very freeing. And she's always positive in saying, yes, you are allowed to experience all the things you want. You just have to manage your time. And I like that. So that's pretty much that chapter for me.
Thank you, Rosemary. That was wonderful. And Geraldine, you're on the line. What do you have to say about chapter 7?
Absolutely. Yep. This is, again, every chapter when you read it, it's like, what's the message here for me? And then how's the message to share with others? And also, what do I agree with and disagree with? And again, this chapter had all of that. So right in the beginning, the subheading of chapter 7 is on the wrong track and moving fast. And that gives a general feel of what this is talking about, whether you're in a job, whether you're in a relationship, whatever you're in. It's about, you know, that perpetual emotion that pulls you forward. So what processes do you have to go, okay, I'm going to stop and look at this. And really interestingly, I think a lot of that is going on in the world right now, where people are having a forced change of circumstances. And that's then resulting in some of this questioning, because we're not able to move as fast on the normal routines that we would. So a really good time to ask some of these questions. A few key points that came out for me was, again, a controversy. There's a big section right in the beginning of the chapter about how to lower stress levels. And it's about feeling management. And she actually says, don't put on a happy face. When you feel rotten, admit it. Don't try to brainwash yourself out of it. You might want to cover up in front of your boss or clients, but never hide your real feelings from yourself. And then I looked at that and said, okay, that's yes, I can say yes to that. But very quickly then, I would then say, what are the tools to change a particular set of feelings that are not moving me, you know, in a direction or allowing, yes, to be in that for a moment, but not to spiral down in it, to understand the biochemistry that we have, where if we rehearse a particular feeling, then we keep making that biochemistry, we keep feeding our cells that information, they make more receptor sites, we happen to want more of that feeling. So while I read that, I think yes, but really great to know the biochemistry behind it and know the tools so that it is okay to say, okay, I'm feeling like this. This is what I'm going to do to feel like that. So I'm not saying deny your feelings. I totally agree. Agree with your feelings, but then do put on a happy face, where she says, don't put on a happy face. Come to the point where, yes, be in that, but then move. So again, there's this ability to move. And as she says, for God's sake, call them by their real names. She's saying, call something, you know, if it's a problem, don't call it a challenge, call it a problem. That's okay with that idea of being real, because it's the first step to be able to be real and to do a confront, or as Parisha shares, come to the front. By bringing it to the front, we can deal with it. However, I'd like to mix that with the idea that I don't see strongly coming out in this chapter, that is, have the tools to lift yourself into a different mindset, into a different way of feeling. Once you've looked at it, once you've looked at the cause of it, she does, and I'm okay with when she says, you know, your feelings won't kill you. Repressing them might do that. So you don't have to walk around feeling lousy. So she says, do you have to walk around feeling lousy all the time? Not at all. So then it's a talk about releasing feelings. And again, into that as well, just watching ourselves that we're not actually rehearsing a set of feelings that will feed our biochemistry so we, you know, end up being like that. So when she says we should visit our feelings on a regular basis, I'm okay with that too. Be real. And without rehearsing them so they become who you are, apply tools that aren't necessarily in this part of the book that I've been looking at. Apply tools that lift you out of those feelings, because it's a different set of feelings that actually gets us into action. She does have steps like that about how do we actually move into a new space as well. For example, she's given the sort of negative examples that people do. They might spend money to cheer themselves up. I think that everybody's heard that term, retail therapy. It doesn't really work long term, and I agree, it's certainly here. But as she does say, you know, if you bury the agenda of why you're doing things, why you're working so much, or why you're, you know, not being social, then it's impossible to change it because it's buried. She gives us a little practice of how much money would you really need to live your dream life? Because this chapter is really for people who are doing well. You are, you know, in a job, you are in whatever it is, and you're just going with that because it's good. So that's a good exercise. And she shares as well that idea of time in exchange. And I know Parish has shared this a lot as well. You know, the only thing you're really spending in life is time. You don't get that back. We can make money again. So really look at what we are exchanging our time for. And a nice exercise in here too is one where she says, read some autobiographies and write some. And in the writing, don't do the last 10 years, but do earlier than that. So if you're 11 or 12 listening to this, you totally write the last 10 years as well. But write earlier than that in little pieces, as she says, vinaigrette, little pieces of writing, just a small section of something from your life, because it can give you a little window into those things that created joy for you. She also shares that a cure for sorrow is to learn something. Now, this is quite lovely. And learn something that's not in your current area of your work. Learn something different. A whole lot of brain research supporting why that works as well. But in this part on the autobiographies, I just wanted to mention as well, there's, again, the overruling theme of ability can never take the place of desire. Now, I'd like to, you know, look more into those two words and whether desire is a positive as we see it or negative. In this case, she's seeing desire as a positive. It's being shown as that which your heart is reaching out for. So when we look at it in that way, there's more that allows us to say, okay, I'm really good at this. I'm obviously successful at it. But does that then give me permission to jump off and do something else? Well, of course it does. That's what it's really saying. And as she said, indicators of your personal genius are not just what you're good at. It's not your aptitude. So this is really the theme of this chapter, chapter 7. I highly recommend having a look at some of the exercises which are towards the back, which is when you find a topic, for example, you know, the work isn't what you expected, and go through it and see how that could work for you. That, you know, the work isn't fulfilling. The work is taking you away from other things. The work is okay, but you don't like the people. And then she says, go through and do these 30-second exercises where you pretend you're a different work. Write down 30 seconds of being a fighter pilot. Write down 30 seconds of being a different. And all these ones allow our brain to be really creative and get in touch with what we're looking at here that could be more what would be called desire or purpose, instead of I'm doing it because it's my ability. So that's the key aspect in chapter 7.
Very good. Yes, and I agree, Geraldine, that sometimes it's really good to be sitting and feeling if you have the habit of denying feeling. But at the same time, if you sit too heavily in feeling and let yourself wallow there, that we could be pretty much overrun by our past experience and not do anything with our lives. So it's a pretty fine balance as to how to really intelligently deal with our feelings without actually letting them hold us back in life and to keep moving forward. So I'm glad you made that point there. Now we've got Trina, who's keen to discuss Chapter 8.
Hello there. Yeah, this chapter, Chapter 8, I really resonated with this one. It's called I Want Something I Shouldn't Want. It's Trivial or Unworthy. And when I read this chapter, I kept thinking, wow, this really feels like the story of my life, because it talks about the impact that the family ideas, your tribe, she calls the family your tribe, that impact and what it has on your dreams. And the first question that kind of came up is, do you feel like you were born into the wrong tribe? And I have so many friends that say, I just don't fit in my family. I don't resonate with a lot of the things that they do or the way that they think. And that was kind of my story. My values and what I loved was so different than so much what was going on in my family. I was the oldest of six, four boys and two girls. And so the expectations were, you know, you can be the mom, you should do this, you should do that. And that was kind of the last chapter I talked about. But there's so much in there in my family about sports, really loving sports and really being connected to a specific religion and all of that. And my interests were off in so many other different directions. I just never really felt like I clicked. A lot of us are caught up in this place of, are we going to do what our family thinks we should do and the values that they have, or are we going to go with our heart? And in this particular chapter, it says this is one of the toughest things that many people have to go through, because rejecting the values of your family or your tribe can be extremely painful. And what we have to keep remembering is that our heart's going to draw us the way we want to go and where our passions are. And for us to have a completely, truly fulfilling life, we need to go for the passions, not what everybody else thinks we should be doing. And that always brings up issues and conflicts and problems in the family. My brother and I always labeled ourselves the black sheep because we didn't fit into this other mold. And here, my parents are certain political beliefs. I'm off on a completely other side of it, and he is too. And we always, at least I feel like I have one person in my family, in my tribe, that I can associate with. Well, they call this in here the ugly duckling syndrome. It's kind of that story of the ugly duckling, where the ugly duckling was really a swan, but being brought up in a family of ducks didn't quite fit in. Everybody thought they were peculiar. And all of a sudden, she grew into this beautiful swan. And everybody realized, oh, wow, she has beauty of her own. Well, one of the key points in this particular chapter that I really loved, there was a sentence in here that said, heredity is as strong as an environment in determining who you are. Carrying genes of ancestors in our DNA, it's not just our parents. It's our grandparents. It's our great-grandparents. It's our ancestors that go back. And what the point she brought out was, well, maybe the reason why, instead of, if you're born into, this was her example, born into a family of generations of barkeeps, but maybe there was someone who was a literary genius and you got those genes. Well, for me, when I read that, that was really big and important to me, because I remember going to Italy and going to the town where some of my ancestors lived and beginning to think about my great-grandmother, who at 24 years old, this was around 1900, packed up her two small children. Her husband had already left to go to America. She packed up her two small children that were one and two, and 19-year-old sister, and traveled at least 3 or 4 hours or more by train to get to Naples, to get on a ship, to travel for a month and hope that she meets her husband in New York. And I thought, wow, what adventure. What a risk taker. I was so excited about that, and I started reflecting back on my life, and I went, wow, I look at things that way. I don't look at things the way my mother does, that, you know, that we want to stay home, we need to stay close together, don't do scary things like take off to Nepal like I did. So the heredity was a piece that I thought was a really key point, because we're not just driven by that immediate family. We're driven by this extended family. So there, a lot of this chapter had to do with exercises to get through some of this, some of the pain that you might feel, and to be able to really jump into your passion and deal with what was going on with your family as well. So one of the exercises that I thought was great was called the Great Debate. And when you kind of break from your tribe, you yourself internally are going to have this debate that goes on in your head. You're going to hear their voices saying why you shouldn't be doing what you're doing, and then you're going to feel your heart saying this is why you should. So her suggestion was take a piece of paper, draw a line down the middle, put tribal voice on the top of one column, personal voice on the top of the other column, and then just start writing down the things that you're hearing. The idea in this whole exercise was to actually find your voice, because as you challenge these negative inputs that are coming in, finding your voice gives you more power. It gives you the ability to come up with logical reasoning or answers to the negativities that come at you. And the key thing about this was that once you get these voices out, then you tend to hear yours more. And who is the one who really has to make the decision for your life? It has to be you, or you're never going to feel fulfilled. So that decision about your life is too important to leave with anybody else. You have to leave it with you. There were also some other exercises about designing your perfect family, grabbing famous people that would support you, and these could be your family, or creating a scenario where your actual family supported you and came back to you. But you can learn to love your family through this. The other thing was step out and find a new family, find a new tribe, find the people that can support you and your ideas. And sometimes that's really scary, it's really shaky, but look for them, hunt for them, call out to them, however you can make it happen. But find another group of people that when you say, I just love animals, I can't stand being in the middle of these literary discussions, and all the people go, oh my gosh, I totally understand exactly where you're coming from. And you can have the conversations that really light up your heart instead of making you feel like you're not connected, you're disconnected. And that's okay, because your life and your passion, you came in as a unique human being with your own gifts, your own fingerprint. Parisha always tells us that we're all born with our own unique fingerprint. We have our own uniqueness to bring to the world. So we need to find that, and sometimes our families just don't understand it. A couple of the other exercises, the perfect fit, it's kind of taking a look at your talents and exactly how would they fit into your dream job. Also, look again, and this has to do with some healing in your family. Look at the strengths that your family gave you. Even though they may not have always supported you, but what did you learn when you were there? Because what's there, you learned there, and some of your key strengths, some of them, your habits, your temperament, your physical characteristics are inherited. Some skills you have, you could have learned from your family. There's so much appreciation to be given to those. And think of the connections that you do have with your family. Draw parallels and be really proud of the things. I know for me, coming around to the end of this chapter was sometimes your family may come around and agree with you. and sometimes they don't. So you can either love them anyway and get to a point in yourself that it doesn't matter what they say anymore, but that you just love them. And sometimes you just have to say, which I do sometimes in my family, we just disagree, so let's just not talk about it and change the subject. Because I love them, and I know they don't get me all the time. And that's okay, because I get me. So that's kind of the summary of Chapter 8.
Thank you. That was wonderful. Very clear. And Rosemary, what did you want to add to that?
Well, one of the things which really struck me in that chapter is the idea of writing down 20 assets you got from your family. And I thought this is a really nice peacemaking kind of exercise. And I remember that there's a lot of assets I got from my family, and especially my ancestors, and getting in touch with all that, what they gave me, the strengths and the determination and other things. So I just like that part very much in that chapter. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, great. Thank you. I found that a really useful exercise as well, doing what my tribe thought and what I thought, because I think ultimately what it showed me was what I fear the most is being so different from them that if I make a mistake or it doesn't work out, then actually brings up a lot of shame because I have their voices in my head. And shame is my own feeling. So it actually helped me see that the limitation is still my own, but the broad difference between some of my beliefs and their beliefs is what makes it even harder when you're venturing out into new territory and you know you're going to trip up and you know you're going to make mistakes. And sometimes you just blindly walk there not knowing if you're even going to make it. And having to deal with, you know, the potentials and that they were right and you were wrong and all of those thoughts come up. So I thought that was really helpful because it showed up more clearly my own thinking and that I need to overcome more just negative programming or fears or meet my own shame in order just to break free to live the full life that I imagine would be right for me, which is obviously different from my family. Everyone's just living what's right for them, and that's all we're meant to be doing on this planet. So just being our unique selves. And I wanted to share yes, you go.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that, you know, the Creator makes no mistakes, and we have chosen that family. And if I look at, I have the same thing like you saying and Trina is saying, my family is very different from what my values are, but it made me the person who I am the way my family was. I mean, I had to really be determined and go against the resistance of my family and find my own values. If they would have been exactly like I was thinking, I probably would have been a weaker person in some way. So I think it's interesting that we all have families who have been so different, and we had to kind of like find our own way in that process. So that's enough for that.
Absolutely. And even when I think of my family, I think, well, the values were beautiful. I mean, beautiful people with wonderful values. And I guess even if you're raised in a family without values that match yours, every difference or every similarity helps you find more of who you are. But even in sharing values, it doesn't mean we share world views or heartfelt passions or interests or how the world works best ideas. In all of that, there's still our unique imprint in this world and our unique perspective. I guess it's like, you know, studying quantum physics versus studying Newtonian physics. And it's like, well, you know, you both could be interested in physics. It's just a really different way of looking at the world, and it then informs very different other actions and, you know, movements in your life. So thinking about Chapter 9, I like the name of this. It says, help, I'm not ready to be born yet. I think it really talks a lot to coming out of one reality, one culture. You know, you could think of one job, like the job of being a student, you know, from the age of 5, we're sort of indoctrinated into this particular way of thinking. And then entering the world of the workplace, which is such a different reality, that we can actually look at it almost like a culture shock. And, you know, no, we're not actually expected to know that we're going, how that movement's going to go and how we're going to feel in that. Like, so, you know, some people might be deluded by saying, well, I don't want to get a job because I feel like a job is the end of life. It's the death of me. You know, life will be boring then. But actually she's saying, no, you just feel like you're not ready to be born yet. And what she means by this and how I've understood it is that the workplace and finding career and all these things helps you learn more and more about who you are. It gives you experience, and it's through that experience that you get closer and closer to your truth. And so she's really advocating for doing some things that make me cringe a little bit, things like, you know, go get that job in that big downtown city in those big four walls with all those hundreds of people. And even if you're in the mailroom, get that job and just go there even when you don't want to, because that job will teach you. So let's say you're in the mailroom, but in the mailroom on a, you know, building of 1,000 people, you'll get to meet the graphic designer, you'll get to meet their receptionist, you'll get to meet their HR person, and you'll get to meet everybody. And in the context of just being around it, you'll start to get a bit closer to your truth. Like you might, you know, chat to the graphic designer and start to go, God, that looks like a really interesting job that you're doing, and start to feel excited by that. So, you know, like she has a point that, like, if you just start anything, something, everything will teach you something, and you're not trapped for the rest of your life. There's nothing that says you have to start here and when you're 80, you know, you'll still be in the same job having your 2 weeks holiday every year. It's not like that. It's like different times now than even potentially our parents lived in, that we can move, we can change, we can grow, we can use every job as our teaching tool to help us move to the next one. So no, we're not trapped in any job. We can definitely move around and use everyone to help us learn. And she's sort of saying, like, well, when you're coming out of one institution, like school, into another, that you're not really, you haven't got your identity formed yet around it. And it can be the hardest time for change, really, because you don't have a strong sense of who you are. So have compassion for yourself about that. And she's given us some hot tips about how to actually get perspective if you get rejected, so that you don't go under. You know, you just keep showing up and keep trying, because something's going to pay off. You just have to keep showing up. One of the tools for handling rejection I liked was that you do your 95-year plan, and you put the ages down on a sheet of paper, and you write down, even if you're only 20, you can still do up to 95. And you write down your major events, what you learnt, and what amazing things you saw. And it just helps you realise how much perspective you can get. So if you get rejected from one job, it isn't the end of the world. I think personally it's a numbers game. So get rejected from a whole lot of jobs, and then eventually you'll find one that gives you a go and starts your journey of learning about yourself and just getting experience about yourself. And I like that she said things like, you know, well, while you're going for interviews, get a group of people together to help be your allies, you know, so that, you know, you can meet with them and they can help boost you up, you know, do steps to help recover your identity, like the 95-year plan, and develop, you know, a sense of acceptance in yourself. You know, all these things are really kind things to do yourself. So I recommend you go through the book. She's got heaps of different tools that you can use to actually help you stay focused. And even if you think you're in the wrong job or the worst job, like, you can do some things to turn it around. You can list what you want to learn out of it. You can find ways to, you know, do things you love about that job. Like, for example, she got us to do an exercise of writing down what your worst job would be, imagining your worst job, and how you would turn that into your best job. And I was thinking about, okay, what's my worst job? Like something like just data entering or editing, because I really dislike editing. I prefer to come up with the ideas in a general way and not actually have to put them on paper in a grammatically perfect way. So I thought, God, editing would be really bad. But then she said, you know, how would you turn that around into a great job? And then I thought, well, I'd just pick the topics I love to edit, you know, and I would then just go, oh, edit everything philosophical, psychological, spiritual, and I would be in heaven editing. I'd just have to learn my editing rules and I'd be good at it. So, you know, she gives us lots of tools about how to turn something that's potentially, you know, what you might think of a negative into something that works for you. I mean, it's really all about you. It's all about us. And every experience is our own personal learning curve. It's really got nothing to do with anybody else. It's our own personal choices. And so just to sum it up, she says on the last page of this chapter, what you are doing is bigger than your career. To learn how to live on this earth, you can't contemplate your navel. You must be engaged in serious activity. Work is a way of learning who you are in the world. And I thought that sums it up really well. Yes, it does. Now, is there anyone that want to comment on that before we move on to Joyce's chapter 10?
Hi, yes, this is a really helpful chapter. It's called regrouping. And you're in a whole new ball game because you don't have any idea what you want. Your life has just changed completely. And I found myself looking back over my own life of the moments when things changed so much that I wasn't just sure what my next steps would be. And even just such experiences as we sold our home at one point and moved to another address. So that meant going to a different school, being with different neighbors. And then when my own mom died, that was a huge step in my life. Everything changed. When each of my sons left home, that was a huge change. When I became divorced, that was a huge change. And then I moved to the United States and to Ohio and then to Arizona. So when you look over your own life, I think each of us recognize that there's sadness sometimes associated with these changes, but there's also a sense of excitement. Because here we are having an opportunity to, as the chapter says, we can regroup. Now, she talks a lot about feelings, and the other co-hosts have definitely covered that greatly in each of the chapters. I think it's so wonderful that our culture in the past has not allowed us really to be honest about our feelings. Barbara Scherer is giving us permission. And through all these ideas, I see a beautiful blanket being woven because the feelings lead us to some pretty amazing conclusions and give us some guidelines of something we might like to do different than what we've ever done and what our heart wants to do. And she talks about a method that if you always have known what you're feeling, but you have buried those feelings, complain anyway. I don't think she's talking about running around and become the giant complainer of the world. What she is saying is it's okay momentarily to express what you're feeling, and then you can move beyond that. She talks about if you're a person that tends to push your feelings away, and that's another way to not deal with your feelings, that just letting go sometimes of being afraid to feel is a very major step. And she talks about if you're a person that wallows and sinks into your feelings so that there's absolutely no clarity in any of your thoughts. So she gives exercises on how to deal with all of that. And the one exercise is for people who can fantasize. And not everyone can do that. So then she moves on to an exercise. If you can't fantasize, to look back over your life and think at age 5, for instance, what were some of your favorite activities? What things did you like doing? And do that for different stages of your life. And then she goes on to an exercise of, okay, what right now do you like doing? And she said, get an empty page of paper and fill every bit of space you can on that paper, even right in the margin, and uncover for yourself all the many, many things you actually like doing now. And the next exercise is to find 20 things you hate to do right now. So this is helping create a pattern for each of us doing this exercise so that then when we want to find what is it that really we're unique to do in this world, in this life, that some of these things start helping us become very clear. And she mentions that when you are doing these kinds of searching, they sometimes obstacles, or I think always some obstacles will show up. So she gives some strategies for that, that create a buddy system, and that you call your buddy system your success team. So whoever's on your success team is doing exactly the same exercises, and you're bouncing ideas off each other. You're bouncing your experiences of trying out some of these things off each other and getting encouragement to just keep plugging in the direction that's normal for you to do and natural. So what your goal is you want to find the unique spirit that's inside you, and to absolutely know that the spirit inside you isn't the same as anybody else's. So this is why it's good to get feedback from other people, because those, especially if you choose people who have known you a long time, those people will be able to reflect back to you, because they will have already, even if they haven't been conscious of it, have some strong sense of the uniqueness of who you are. And making mistakes helps us become wise. And not everyone really understands or accepts that, because we've been taught if you make a mistake, somehow you're less a person. You're not a good person. You shouldn't make mistakes. Well, making mistakes is how we learn. And she has an exercise that she describes that you can pretend you have an imaginary twin. And that imaginary twin has wanted to do all kinds of things but has done nothing with their life. And you can work with that exercise. And in conclusion, what I feel she's teaching us in a very strong, powerful way is we want to get familiar with how we're feeling. We want to accept and know it's good to have feelings and recognize them and bring them out into our own awareness. We want to use our feelings to get honest with ourselves instead of getting buried in our feelings and feeling like we can't make any decisions, we're lost. We're going to use those feelings as very important tools to get us where we want to go. So learn and accept ourselves. We're unique, and use that uniqueness and give yourself permission to have feelings. Use those feelings as your guideposts to new decisions and new way of life and the things that you are natural and meant to be doing in this lifetime. And that was what I felt about this chapter and regrouping. It's a whole new ball game.
Thank you, Joyce. Well, what do we do if the feelings are just so plagued with self-hate and anxieties and fears? And what if we've been told it's unsafe to leave the house? You know, so what do we do when the feelings that we're feeling are so big that they actually get in the way of even turning up to the first interview or putting in the first application or even dreaming? You know, it's an interesting concept of sitting fully in feeling when it's actually sometimes the feelings that are holding us back from sitting fully in life. You know, it's a tricky dilemma to have one rule one way or another about sitting in it or not sitting in it. I think we need to look at it, you know, in a, you know, case by case, moment by moment sort of basis, I think. Do other people have thoughts about that or anything else?
Absolutely. And I guess one can only draw from personal experience. So while I'm reading it, I go into my own life. What did I do? How could that be different? And when have I moved through, you know, deep times of sorrow or self-questioning? Or they're all there. Yeah, they're all peppered through life. And so when I look at that and the people around me, it's the ability not to avoid those situations, but the ability to come out of it. And I remember a story from a high-performance coach who was doing a business lecture, and they said the top 30 tennis players have the same ability level, more or less, the same speed of hitting a ball, et cetera, et cetera. What separated those who were the absolute, you know, top from the rest of that pack was their ability to come back to high performance after they'd hit a double let or, you know, knocked the ball out. That was the difference that separated them. So I guess in each of our lives, we need to be able to say,
what's true for me? And true for me, yes, I could say I can see how my life has this pattern of seeking to be a high performer, and I can see, ask the questions why. I might say that the motivations for them may not have always been, you know, the most survival oriented, but now that I know them and I have those skills, I can still be who I am and just know that my motivation has shifted. So do I want to be the best I can be, meaning how much can I be effective in contributing who I am? Then there's the ability to get over myself, as it would be said, to see that I've gone down, I've done that double let, I've knocked the tennis ball out, and now I can regain. So I strongly believe in having tools, and a lot of those tools are about looking out into the world, about assisting others, the famous saying, get over yourself. So I do apply those. They work very well for me, including music. If it's all too hard, I put on a song that I really like. These things are powerful. They're personal, but they work. This is Trina, and what I really love about this book, and for me, it's actually been quite emotional. Even just reading the title for me, I think I shared before, it's like I could feel the emotion starting to come up in me. But what's really cool is that she comes at it from so many different ways, because I really believe there's so many of us that are looking for our dreams, or we haven't landed in our special jobs, or I only know a couple people in my life that have just pursued exactly what they wanted to do from the time they were a small child. So what's really awesome, I think, in this book is the beginning of it kind of carves out that general, but then she kind of hits all the little voices that are in your head and all the little questions, or what do you hear your mind saying to you, or where is it that you can feel the emotion that's welling up in you? And there's some of these chapters I read and it's like, okay, I don't really feel resonance with this one. And then I read another one and it's like, oh my gosh, I'm sitting here holding the tears back. So this book is like for everybody, it's for everyone who really feels like they haven't completely reached their dream, haven't really discovered their true self, and would love to explore more of who they are. So I just absolutely love this. This book is just great.
Well, I like to comment on the feeling thing. You know, in a way, this book is a little bit going back to memory lane, because it was written in 1995. And I remember at that time, I was still sitting down, and maybe some of you remember, and we were writing affirmations, you know. And it was really, there was a time, maybe a little bit earlier, I mean, she probably wrote the book earlier, it was published in 1995. I mean, when we were still working with childhood trauma, and we had to go back, and we had to deal with this, nobody was talking about frequencies and raising your frequencies and emotional addiction. I mean, the only addiction was alcohol and that kind of stuff, but emotional addiction that came later. So in a way, you know, that's what the book is a little bit about, that she's coming from that term. And I agree with Trina. I mean, she's so creative and she's so practical. And I really like the idea she was trying to get across, that that your job is not really your life. Your job is to have a life you love. And so she's expanding the idea of having a good life. And it's not based on what you do between 9 to 5 or what your work is. Your job is really to create a good life. And I think we all can still probably improve on that. There's always something I still like to do to make my life more lovable and better. And the other idea I like is that she says that the skills you have don't make yourself a happy life. I mean, you have to really do what you love. Or she says somewhere, you actually have to first find out what you love. And I think there's still so much things I like to do, which I love, like writing or drawing, or I even want to sing again. I want to play an instrument. And there's so many things, and they are beyond work. And I think that's what she's trying to get to. Just do everything you want to do. And it doesn't mean something which has nothing to do with work. It is about having a life you love. So that's what I wanted to say.
Absolutely. Yeah, great. And Joyce, what did you want to comment on?
I just find it very, very interesting that with every chapter that she has written in this book, the bottom line really is that if you give yourself permission to look honestly at what your feelings are, it diffuses those feelings and somehow gives you then the concentration, the confidence, and the power to make them useful to you instead of a block. And by finding out what you're feeling and why you're feeling and how else you'd like to feel, then things can be very different.
Yes. I'd just like to put a little caveat on that statement, Joyce, though, because I've been working with people with heavy trauma for the last 20 years, and I realize in that the feelings can be so overwhelming, so big, that any new thing can trigger all the abuse of mistakes of the past and, you know, just all the levels of feelings that actually relate to old experiences. And sometimes that can get really clouded, that it looks like it can relate to, say, going for the new job, but it actually relates to dad's voice in your head that happened over, you know, your whole childhood, and that the feelings are overwhelming and they're actually triggered by doing something new. So, you know, I think, you know, for some of my clients who were heavily traumatized, sometimes just that skill of putting that totally aside, being able to block it off and do life anyway until they're actually ready. Sometimes that's years later, sometimes that's 20 years later, so they're ready to actually process and let go of those really deep, dark pain that they've boxed off. And they've managed to have a really successful, happy career because they put their feelings aside. So, you know, I just think it's a case by case on that. I just wanted to add that for all the people out there that are dealing with, you know, heavy loads of pain and trauma from the past. Is there anyone else that would like to make comment before we finish? We're about to come to the end now.
Geraldine, just one second here. Is on LinkedIn, when I've, you know, when we put about reading the book, there's quite a few comments from people who say, I read this book and it gave me the courage to change my career. And I think that's a big part of it, whether it be a career, a relationship, whatever. It's about that courage. So having all the information in these chapters provides, one, to ask the question, two, to look at the fear, do the confront or the come to the front, and then make a change if you need to. So that's an important part, to get this feedback from people that they're actually making changes and loving their new careers. And I can see what they're doing on LinkedIn because of applying what's in this book.
Absolutely. Thank you for that. So it's time to conclude our studies, and we thank you for sharing your time and energy with us. You matter and count, so you always make a difference. We look forward to being with us next week as we make a leap into greater consciousness. Have a powerful week. Allow your light to shine, and always, all good things to you.
Thank you for listening to Quantum Leap Book Club. For more information where you can contact us, go to loaradionetwork.com/quantum-leap. Have a great week.